sharply to her ideas of propriety, and tried to teach Scarlett to do the same, but with poor success. Ellen had stepped to the mantel to take her rosary beads from the small inlaid casket in which they always reposed when Mammy spoke up with firmness.
"Miss Ellen, you go and eat some supper before you does any praying."
"Thank you, Mammy, but I am not hungry."
"I go and fix your supper myself and you eats it," said Mammy, her brow furrowed with indignation as she started down the hall for the kitchen. "Polk," she called. "Tell Cookie stir up the fire. Miss Ellen home."
As the board shuddered under her weight, the soliloquy she had been muttering in the front hall grew louder and louder, coming clearly to the ears of the family in the dining room.
"I has said time and again it don't do no good doing nothing for white trash. They is the shiftless, most ungrateful parcel of no counts living. And Miss Ellen got no business wearing herself out waiting on folks that, did they be worth shooting, they had niggers to wait on them. And I has said..."
Her voice trailed off as she went down the long open passageway, covered only by a roof that led into the kitchen. Mammy had her own method of letting her owners know exactly where she stood on all matters. She knew it was beneath the dignity of quality white folks to pay the slightest attention to what a darky said when she was just grumbling to herself. She knew that to uphold this dignity, they must ignore what she said, even if she stood in the next room and almost shouted. It protected her from reproof, and it left no doubt in anyone's mind as to her exact views on any subject. Pork entered the room, bearing a plate, silver, and a napkin. He was followed closely by Jack, a black little boy of 10, hastily buttoning a white linen jacket with one hand and bearing in the other a fly swisher made of thin strips of newspaper, tied to a reed longer than he was. Ellen had a beautiful peacock feather fly brusher, but it was used only on very special occasions and then only after domestic struggle, due to the obstinate conviction of Pork, Cookie, and Mammy, that peacock feathers were bad luck. Ellen sat down in the chair which Gerald pulled out for her, and four voices attacked her.
"Mother, the lace is loose on my new ball dress, and I want to wear it tomorrow night at 12 Oaks. Won't you please fix it? Mother, Scarlett's new dress is prettier than mine, and I look like a fright in pink. Why can't she wear my pink and let me wear her green? She looks all right in pink. Mother, can I stay up for the ball tomorrow night? I'm 13 now."
"Mrs. O'Hara, would you believe it? Hush, you girls, before I take me crop to you. Cade Calvert was in Atlanta this morning, and he says, 'Will you be quiet and let me be hearing me own voice?' And he says... it's all upset they are there and talking nothing but war, militia drilling, troops forming. And he says the news from Charleston is that they will be putting up with no more Yankee insults."
Ellen's tired mouth smiled into the tumult as she addressed herself first to her husband, as a wife should. If the nice people of Charleston feel that way, I'm sure we will all feel the same way soon, she said. For she had a deeply rooted belief that, excepting only Savannah, most of the gentle blood of the whole continent could be found in that small seaport city, a belief shared largely by Charlestonians. "No, Corrine, next year, dear. Then you can stay up for balls and wear grown-up dresses. And what a good time my little pink cheeks will have. Don't pout, dear. You can go to the barbecue, remember that, and stay up through supper, but no balls till you are 14. Give me your gown, Scarlett. I will whip the lace for you after prayers. So, Ellen, I do not like your tone, dear. Your pink gown is lovely and suitable to your complexion, as Scarlett's is to hers. But you may wear my garnet necklace tomorrow night." Sue Ellen, behind her mother's back, wrinkled her nose triumphantly at Scarlett, who had been planning to beg the necklace for herself. Scarlett put out her tongue at her. Sue Ellen was an annoying sister with her whining and selfishness. And had it not been for Ellen's restraining hand, Scarlet would frequently have boxed her ears.
"Now, Mr. O'Hara, tell me more about what Mr. Calvert said about Charleston," said Ellen.
Scarlet knew her mother cared nothing at all about war and politics, and thought them masculine matters about which no lady could intelligently concern herself. But it gave Gerald pleasure to air his views, and Ellen was unfailingly thoughtful of her husband's pleasure. While Gerald launched forth on his news, Mammy set the plates before her mistress, golden-topped biscuits, breast of fried chicken, and a yellow yam open and steaming, with melted butter dripping from it. Mammy pinched small Jack, and he hastened to his business of slowly swishing the paper ribbons back and forth behind Ellen. Mammy stood beside the table, watching every forkful that traveled from plate to mouth, as though she intended to force the food down Ellen's throat should she see signs of flagging. Ellen ate diligently. But Scarlet could see that she was too tired to know what she was eating. Only Mammy's implacable face forced her to it. When the dish was empty, and Gerald only midway in his remarks on the thievishness of Yankees, who wanted to free darkies and yet offered no penny to pay for their freedom, Ellen rose.
"We'll be having prayers?"
he questioned reluctantly.
"Yes. It is so late. Why, it is actually 10 o'clock, as the clock with coughing and tinny thumps marked the hour. Corrine should have been asleep long ago. The lamp, please, Pork. And my prayer book, Mammy." Prompted by Mammy's hoarse whisper, Jack set his fly brush in the corner and removed the dishes, while Mammy fumbled in the sideboard drawer for Ellen's worn prayer book. Pork, tiptoeing, reached the ring in the chain and drew the lamp slowly down until the tabletop was brightly bathed in light and the ceiling receded into shadows. Ellen arranged her skirts and sank to the floor on her knees, laying the open prayer book on the table before her and clasping her hands upon it. Gerald knelt beside her, and Scarlet and Sue Ellen took their accustomed places on the opposite side of the table, folding their voluminous petticoats in pads under their knees so that they would ache less from contact with the hard floor. Corrine, who was small for her age, could not kneel comfortably at the table and so knelt facing a chair, her elbows on the seat. She liked this position, for she seldom failed to go to sleep during prayers, and in this posture, it escaped her mother's notice. The house servant shuffled and rustled in the hall to kneel by the doorway, Mammy groaning aloud as she sank down, Pork straight as a ramrod. Rosa and Tina, the maids, graceful in their spreading bright calicoes, Cookie gaunt and yellow beneath her snowy head rag, and Jack, stupid with sleep, as far away from Mammy's pinching fingers as possible. Their dark eyes gleamed expectantly, for praying with their white folks was one of the events of the day. The old and colorful phrases of the litany with its oriental imagery meant little to them, but it satisfied something in their hearts. And they always swayed when they chanted the responses. "Lord, have mercy on us. Christ, have mercy on us." Ellen closed her eyes and began praying, her voice rising and falling, lulling and soothing. Heads bowed in the circle of yellow light as Ellen thanked God for the health and happiness of her home, her family, and her Negroes. When she had finished her prayers for those beneath the roof of Tara, her father, mother, sisters, 3 dead babies, and all the poor souls in purgatory, she clasped her white beads between long fingers and began the rosary. Like the rushing of a soft wind, the responses from black throats and white throats rolled back. "Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death." Despite her heartache and the pain of unshed tears, a deep sense of quiet and peace fell upon Scarlet, as it always did at this hour. Some of the disappointment of the day and the dread of the morrow departed from her, leaving a feeling of hope. It was not the lifting up of her heart to God that brought this balm, for religion went no more than lip-deep with her. It was the sight of her mother's serene face upturned to the throne of God and his saints and angels, praying for blessings on those whom she loved. When Ellen intervened with heaven, Scarlett felt certain that heaven heard. Ellen finished, and Gerald, who could never find his beads at prayer time, began furtively counting his decade on his fingers. As his voice droned on, Scarlett's thoughts strayed, in spite of herself. She knew she should be examining her conscience. Ellen had taught her that at the end of each day it was her duty to examine her conscience thoroughly, to admit her numerous faults, and pray to God for forgiveness and strength, never to repeat them. But Scarlett was examining her heart. She dropped her head upon her folded hands so that her mother could not see her face, and her thoughts went sadly back to Ashley. How could he be planning to marry Melanie when he really loved her, Scarlett? And when he knew how much she loved him, how could he deliberately break her heart? Then, suddenly, an idea, shining anew, flashed like a comet through her brain. Why, Ashley hasn't an idea that I'm in love with him. She almost gasped aloud in the shock of its unexpectedness. Her mind stood still, as if paralyzed for a long, breathless instant, and then raced forward. How could he know? I've always acted so prissy and ladylike, and touch-me-not around him, he probably thinks I don't care a thing about him except as a friend. Yes, that's why he's never spoken. He thinks his love is hopeless, and that's why he's looked so... Her mind went swiftly back to those times when she had caught him looking at her in that strange manner, when the grey eyes that were such perfect curtains for his thoughts had been wide and naked, and had in them a look of torment and despair. He's been broken-hearted because he thinks I'm in love with Brent, a steward, a Cade, and probably he thinks that if he can't have me, he might as well please his family and marry Melanie. But if he knew I did love him... Her volatile spirit shot up from deepest depression to excited happiness. This was the answer to Ashley's reticence, to his strange conduct. He didn't know. Her vanity leaped to the aid of her desire to believe, making belief a certainty. If he knew she loved him, he would hasten to her side. She had only to... Oh, she thought rapturously, digging her fingers into her lowered brow. What a fool I've been not to think of this till now. I must think of some way to let him know. He wouldn't marry her if he knew I loved him. How could he? With a start, she realized that Gerald had finished, and her mother's eyes were on her. Hastily she began her decade, telling off the beads automatically, but with a depth of emotion in her voice that caused Mammy to open her eyes and shoot a searching glance at her. As she finished her prayers and Sue Ellen, then Corrine, began their decades, her mind was still speeding onward with her entrancing new thought. Even now, it wasn't too late. Too often the county had been scandalized by elopements when one or the other of the participating parties was practically at the altar with a third. And Ashley's engagement had not even been announced yet. Yes, there was plenty of time. If no love lay between Ashley and Melanie, but only a promise given long ago, then why wasn't it possible for him to break that promise and marry her? Surely he would do it, if he knew that she, Scarlett, loved him. She must find some way to let him know. She would find some way. And then... Scarlett came abruptly out of her dream of delight, for she had neglected to make the responses, and her mother was looking at her reprovingly. As she resumed the ritual, she opened her eyes briefly and cast a quick glance around the room. The kneeling figures, the soft glow of the lamp, the dim shadows where the Negroes swayed, even the familiar objects that had been so hateful to her sight an hour ago, in an instant, took on the color of her own emotions, and the room seemed once more a lovely place. She would never forget this moment or this scene. "Virgin most faithful," her mother intoned. The litany of the Virgin was beginning, and obediently Scarlet responded,
"Pray for us."
As Ellen praised in soft contralto the attributes of the Mother of God. As always, since childhood, this was for Scarlet a moment for adoration of Ellen, rather than the Virgin. Sacrilegious though it might be, Scarlet always saw, through her closed eyes, the upturned face of Ellen, and not the Blessed Virgin, as the ancient phrases were repeated. Health of the sick, seat of wisdom, refuge of sinners, mystical rose. They were beautiful words, because they were the attributes of Ellen. But tonight, because of the exaltation of her own spirit, Scarlet found in the whole ceremonial, the softly spoken words, the murmur of the responses, a surpassing beauty beyond any that she had ever experienced before. And her heart went up to God in sincere thankfulness that a pathway for her feet had been opened, out of her misery, and straight into the arms of Ashley. When the last Amen sounded, they all rose, somewhat stiffly, Mammy being hauled to her feet by the combined efforts of Tina and Rosa. Pork took a long spiller from the mantelpiece, lit it from the lamp flame, and went into the hall. Opposite the winding stairs stood a walnut sideboard, too large for use in the dining room, bearing on its wide top several lamps and a long row of candles in candlesticks. Pork lit one lamp and three candles, and, with the pompous dignity of a first chamberlain of the royal bedchamber lighting a king and queen to their rooms, he led the procession up the stairs, holding the light high above his head. Ellen, on Gerald's arm, followed him, and the girls, each taking her own candlestick, mounted after them. Scarlet entered her room, set the candle on the tall chest of drawers, and fumbled in the dark closet for the dancing dress that needed stitching. Throwing it across her arm, she crossed the hall quietly. The door of her parents' bedroom was slightly ajar, and before she could knock, Ellen's voice, low but stern, came to her ears. "Mr. O'Hara, you must dismiss Jonas Wilkerson." Gerald exploded. "And where will I be getting another overseer who wouldn't be cheating me out of me eye teeth?" "He must be dismissed immediately, tomorrow morning. Big Sam is a good foreman, and he can take over the duties until you can hire another overseer." "Aha!" came Gerald's voice. "So, I understand. Then the worthy Jonas sired the—" "He must be dismissed."
"So, he is the father of Emmy Slattery's baby," thought Scarlet. "Oh, well, what else can you expect from Yankee man and white trash girl?"
Then, after a discreet pause which gave Gerald's splutterings time to die away, she knocked on the door and handed the dress to her mother. By the time Scarlet had undressed and blown out the candle, her plan for tomorrow had worked itself out in every detail. It was a simple plan, for, with Gerald's single-mindedness of purpose, her eyes were centered on the goal, and she thought only of the most direct steps by which to reach it. First, she would be prideful, as Gerald had commanded. From the moment she arrived at 12 Oaks, she would be her gayest, most spirited self. No one would suspect that she had ever been downhearted because of Ashley and Melanie, and she would flirt with every man there. That would be cruel to Ashley, but it would make him yearn for her all the more. She wouldn't overlook a man of marriageable age, from ginger-whiskered old Frank Kennedy, who was Sue Ellen's beau, on down to shy, quiet, blushing Charles Hamilton, Melanie's brother. They would swarm around her like bees around a hive, and certainly Ashley would be drawn from Melanie to join the circle of her admirers. Then, somehow, she would maneuver to get a few minutes alone with him, away from the crowd. She hoped everything would work out that way, because it would be more difficult otherwise. But if Ashley didn't make the first move, she would simply have to do it herself. When they were finally alone, he would have fresh in his mind the picture of the other men thronging about her. He would be newly impressed with the fact that every one of them wanted her, and that look of sadness and despair would be in his eyes. Then she would make him happy again, by letting him discover that, popular though she was, she preferred him above any other man in all the world. And when she admitted it, modestly and sweetly, she would look a thousand things more. Of course, she would do it all in a ladylike way. She wouldn't even dream of saying to him boldly that she loved him. That would never do. But the manner of telling him was a detail that troubled her not at all. She had managed such situations before, and she could do it again. Lying in the bed, with the moonlight streaming dimly over her, she pictured the whole scene in her mind. She saw the look of surprise and happiness that would come over his face when he realized that she really loved him, and she heard the words he would say, asking her to be his wife. Naturally, she would have to say then that she simply couldn't think of marrying a man when he was engaged to another girl. But he would insist, and finally, she would let herself be persuaded. Then they would decide to run off to Jonesboro that very afternoon, and... why, by this time tomorrow night, she might be Mrs. Ashley Wilkes. She sat up in bed, hugging her knees, and for a long, happy moment, she was Mrs. Ashley Wilkes, Ashley's bride. Then a slight chill entered her heart. Suppose it didn't work out this way. Suppose Ashley didn't beg her to run away with him. Resolutely, she pushed the thought from her mind. "I won't think of that now," she said firmly. "If I think of it now, it will upset me. There's no reason why things won't come out the way I want them. If he loves me, and I know he does." She raised her chin, and her pale, black-fringed eyes sparkled in the moonlight. Ellen had never told her that desire and attainment were two different matters. Life had not taught her that the race was not to the swift. She lay in the silvery shadows with courage rising and made the plans that a 16-year-old makes when life has been so pleasant that defeat is an impossibility, and a pretty dress and a clear complexion are weapons to vanquish fate. Chapter 5. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. The day was warm for April, and the golden sunlight streamed brilliantly into Scarlett's room through the blue curtains of the wide windows. The cream-colored walls glowed with light, and the depths of the mahogany furniture gleamed deep red like wine, while the floor glistened as if it were glass, except where the rag rugs covered it. And they were spots of gay color. Already, summer was in the air. The first hint of Georgia summer when the high tide of spring gives way reluctantly before a fiercer heat. A balmy, soft warmth poured into the room, heavy with velvety smells, redolent of many blossoms, of newly fledged trees and of moist, freshly turned red earth. Through the window, Scarlett could see the bright riot of the twin lines of daffodils bordering the gravel driveway, and the golden masses of yellow jessamine spreading flowery sprangles modestly to the earth like crinolines. The mockingbirds and the jays, engaged in their old feud for possession of the magnolia tree beneath her window, were bickering. The jays strident, acrimonious, the mockers sweet-voiced and plaintive. Such a glowing morning usually called Scarlett to the window, to lean arms on the broad sill and drink in the scents and sounds of Terra. But today, She had no eye for sun or azure sky beyond a hasty thought. Thank God it isn't raining. On the bed lay the apple-green, watered silk ball dress with its festoons of ecru lace, neatly packed in a large cardboard box. It was ready to be carried to 12 Oaks to be donned before the dancing began, but Scarlet shrugged at the sight of it. If her plans were successful, she would not wear that dress tonight. Long before the ball began, she and Ashley would be on their way to Jonesboro to be married. The troublesome question was, what dress should she wear to the barbecue? What dress would best set off her charms and make her most irresistible to Ashley? Since 8 o'clock, she had been trying on and rejecting dresses, and now she stood dejected and irritable in lace pantalettes, linen corset cover, and 3 billowing lace and linen petticoats. Discarded garments lay about her on the floor, the bed, the chairs, in bright heaps of color and straying ribbons. The rose organdy with long pink sash was becoming, but she had worn it last summer when Melanie visited 12 Oaks, and she'd be sure to remember it. And might be catty enough to mention it. The black bombazine with its puffed sleeves and princess lace collar set off her white skin superbly, but it did make her look a trifle elderly. Scarlet peered anxiously in the mirror at her 16-year-old face, as if expecting to see wrinkles and sagging chin muscles. It would never do to appear sedate and elderly before Melanie's sweet youthfulness. The lavender-barred muslin was beautiful, with those wide insets of lace and net about the hem, but it had never suited her type. It would suit Corrine's delicate profile and wishy-washy expression perfectly, but Scarlet felt that it made her look like a schoolgirl. It would never do to appear schoolgirlish beside Melanie's poised self. The green plaid taffeta, frothing with flounces, and each flounce edged in green velvet ribbon, was most becoming, in fact her favorite dress, for it darkened her eyes to emerald. But there was unmistakably a grease spot on the front of the basque. Of course, her brooch could be pinned over the spot, but perhaps Melanie had sharp eyes. There remained varicolored cotton dresses, which Scarlet felt were not festive enough for the occasion, ball dresses, and the green-sprigged muslin she had worn yesterday. But it was an afternoon dress. It was not suitable for a barbecue, for it had only tiny puffed sleeves, and the neck was low enough for a dancing dress. But there was nothing else to do but wear it. After all, she was not ashamed of her neck and arms and bosom, even if it was not correct to show them in the morning. As she stood before the mirror and twisted herself about to get a side view, she thought that there was absolutely nothing about her figure to cause her shame. Her neck was short but rounded, and her arms plump and enticing. Her breasts, pushed high by her stays, were very nice breasts. She had never had to sew tiny rows of silk ruffles in the lining of her basques, as most 16-year-old girls did, to give their figures the desired curves and fullness. She was glad she had inherited Ellen's slender white hands and tiny feet, and she wished she had Ellen's height, too, but her own height pleased her very well. What a pity legs could not be shown, she thought, pulling up her petticoats and regretfully viewing them, plump and neat under pantalettes. She had such nice legs. Even the girls at the Fayetteville Academy had admitted as much. And as for her waist, there was no one in Fayetteville, Jonesboro, or 3 counties, for that matter, who had so small a waist. The thought of her waist brought her back to practical matters. The green muslin measured 17 inches about the waist, and Mammy had laced her for the 18-inch bombazine. Mammy would have to lace her tighter. She pushed open the door, listened, and heard Mammy's heavy tread in the downstairs hall. She shouted for her impatiently, knowing she could raise her voice with impunity, as Ellen was in the smokehouse, measuring out the day's food to Cookie. "Some folks thinks as how I can fly," grumbled Mammy, shuffling up the stairs. She entered puffing, with the expression of one who expects battle and welcomes it. In her large black hands was a tray upon which food smoked, two large yams covered with butter, a pile of buckwheat cakes dripping syrup, and a large slice of ham swimming in gravy. Catching sight of Mammy's burden, Scarlett's expression changed from one of minor irritation to obstinate belligerency. In the excitement of trying on dresses, she had forgotten Mammy's ironclad rule that, before going to any party, the O'Hara girls must be crammed so full of food at home they would be unable to eat any refreshments at the party.
"It's no use. I won't eat it. You can just take it back to the kitchen."
Mammy set the tray on the table and squared herself, hands on hips.
"Yas'm, you is. I ain't figuring on having happen what happened at the last barbecue when I was too sick from them chitlins I ate to fetch you no tray before you went. You is gwine eat every bite of this."
"I am not. Now come here and lace me tighter, because we are late already."
I heard the carriage come round to the front of the house. Mammy's tone became wheedling.
"Now, Miss Scarlett, you be good and come eat just a little. Miss Corrie and Miss Llewellyn done eat all day and—"
"They would," said Scarlett contemptuously.
"They haven't any more spirit than a rabbit. But I won't. I'm through with trays. I'm not forgetting the time I ate a whole tray and went to the Calvert's and they had ice cream out of ice they'd brought all the way from Savannah, and I couldn't eat but a spoonful. I'm going to have a good time today and eat as much as I please."
At this defiant heresy, Mammy's brow lowered with indignation. What a young miss could do and what she could not do were as different as black and white in Mammy's mind. There was no middle ground of deportment between. Llewellyn and Corrine were clay in her powerful hands, and hearkened respectfully to her warning. But it had always been a struggle to teach Scarlett that most of her natural impulses were unladylike. Mammy's victories over Scarlett were hard won, and represented guile unknown to the white mind.
"If you don't care about how folks talks about this family, I does," she rumbled. "I ain't gwine stand by and have everybody at the party saying how you ain't futched up right. I has told you and told you that you can always tell a lady by that she eat like a bird. And I ain't aiming to have you go to Miss Wilkes and eat like a field hand and gobble like a hog."
"Mother is a lady and she eats," countered Scarlett.
"When you is mad, you can eat too," retorted Mammy. "When Miss Ellen your age, she never ate nothing when she went out. And neither your Aunt Pauline nor Aunt Eulalie. And they all done mad. Young missus what eats heavy most generally don't catch husbands."
"I don't believe it. At the barbecue when you were sick and I didn't eat beforehand, Ashley Wilkes told me he liked to see a girl with a healthy appetite."
Mammy shook her head ominously.
"What gentlemen say and what they thinks is two different things. And I ain't noticed Miss Ashley axin' for to marry you."
Scarlett scowled, started to speak sharply, and then caught herself. Mammy had her there, and there was no argument. Seeing the obdurate look on Scarlett's face, Mammy picked up the tray and, with the bland guile of her race, changed her tactics. As she started for the door, she sighed.
"Well, all right. I was telling Cookie while she was a-fixin' this tray, you can sure tell a lady by what she don't eat. And I say to Cookie, I ain't never seed no white lady who et less'n Miss Melanie Hamilton did last time she was visitin' Mr. Ashley. I mean, visitin' Miss India."
Scarlett shot a look of sharp suspicion at her, but Mammy's broad face carried only a look of innocence and of regret that Scarlett was not the lady Melanie Hamilton was.
"Put down that tray and come lace me tighter," said Scarlett irritably. "And I'll try to eat a little afterwards. If I ate now, I couldn't lace tight enough."
Cloaking her triumph, Mammy set down the tray.
What Malem Gwon wear?
That, answered Scarlet, pointing at the fluffy mass of green-flowered muslin. Instantly, Mammy was in arms.
No, you ain't. It ain't fitten for mornin'. You can't show your bosom before 3 o'clock, and dat dress ain't got no neck and no sleeves. And you get freckled sure as your bone. And I ain't figuring on you getting freckled after all the buttermilk I've been putting on you all this winter, bleaching them freckles you got at Savannah setting on the beach. I sure gwan speak to your mama about you.
If you say one word to her before I'm dressed, I won't eat a bite, said Scarlet coolly. Mother won't have time to send me back to change once I'm dressed.
Mammy sighed resignedly, beholding herself outguessed. Between the two evils, it was better to have Scarlet wear an afternoon dress at a morning barbecue than to have her gobble like a hog.
"Hold on to something and suck in your breath,"
she commanded. Scarlet obeyed, bracing herself and catching firm hold of one of the bedposts. Mammy pulled and jerked vigorously, and as the tiny circumference of the whalebone-girdled waist grew smaller, a proud, fond look came into her eyes.
"Ain't nobody got a waist like my lamb,"
she said approvingly.
"Every time I pulls Miss Sue Ellen littler than 20 inches, she up and faint."
"Pooh," gasped Scarlet, speaking with difficulty. "I never fainted in my life."
"Well, 'twouldn't do no harm if you was to faint now and then,"
advised Mammy.
"You is so brash sometimes, Miss Scarlet. I've been aiming to tell you, it just don't look good the way you don't faint about snakes and mouses and such. I don't mean round home, but when you is out in company, and I has told you, and—"
"Oh, hurry. Don't talk so much. I'll catch a husband. See if I don't. Even if I don't scream and faint. Goodness, but my stays are tight. Put on the dress."
Mammy carefully dropped the 12 yards of green-sprigged muslin over the mountainous petticoats and hooked up the back of the tight, low-cut basque.
"You keep your shawl on your shoulders when you is in the sun, and don't you go taking off your hat when you is warm,"
she commanded.
"Elsewise you'll be coming home looking brown like old Miss Slattery. Now you come eat, honey, but don't eat too fast. No use having it come right back up again."
Scarlet obediently sat down before the tray, wondering if she would be able to get any food into her stomach and still have room to breathe. Mammy plucked a large towel from the washstand and carefully tied it around Scarlet's neck, spreading the white folds over her lap. Scarlet began on the ham, because she liked ham, and forced it down.
"I wish to heaven I was married," she said resentfully, as she attacked the yams with loathing. "I'm tired of everlastingly being unnatural and never doing anything I want to do. I'm tired of acting like I don't eat more than a bird, and walking when I want to run, and saying I feel faint after a waltz, when I could dance for 2 days and never get tired. I'm tired of saying, 'How wonderful you are,' to fool men who haven't got one half the sense I've got. And I'm tired of pretending I don't know anything so men can tell me things and feel important while they're doing it. I can't eat another bite."
"Try a hot cake,"
said Mammy inexorably.
"Why is it a girl has to be so silly to catch a husband?"
"I specs it's 'cause gentlemen's don't know what they wants. They just know what they think they wants. And giving them what they think they wants saves a pile of misery and being an old maid. And they think they wants mousy little gals with birds' tastes and no sense at all. It don't make a gentleman feel like marrying a lady if he suspicions she got more sense than he has."
"Don't you suppose men get surprised after they're married to find that their wives do have sense?"
"Well, it's too late then. They's already married. Sides, gentlemen specs their wives to have sense.
Some day I'm going to do and say everything I want to do and say, and if people don't like it, I don't care.
No, you ain't, said Mammy grimly. Not well I got breath. You eat dem cakes. Sop them into gravy, honey.
I don't think Yankee girls have to act like such fools. When we were at Saratoga last year, I noticed plenty of them acting like they had right good sense, and in front of men, too.
Mammy snorted. Yankee gals. Yes'm. I guess they speaks their minds all right, but I ain't noticed many of them getting proposed to at Saratoga.
But Yankees must get married, argued Scarlet. They don't just grow. They must get married and have children. There's too many of them.
Men marries them for the money, said Mammy firmly.
Scarlet sopped the wheat cake in the gravy and put it in her mouth. Perhaps there was something in what Mammy said. There must be something in it, for Ellen said the same things, in different and more delicate words. In fact, the mothers of all her girlfriends impressed on their daughters the necessity of being helpless, clinging, doe-eyed creatures. Really, it took a lot of sense to cultivate and hold such a pose. Perhaps she had been too brash. Occasionally she had argued with Ashley and frankly aired her opinions. Perhaps this and her healthy enjoyment of walking and riding had turned him from her to the frail Melanie. Perhaps if she changed her tactics. But she felt that if Ashley succumbed to premeditated feminine tricks, she could never respect him as she now did. Any man who was fool enough to fall for a simper, a feint, and an, "Oh, how wonderful you are," wasn't worth having. But they all seemed to like it. If she had used the wrong tactics with Ashley in the past, well, that was the past and done with. Today she would use different ones, the right ones. She wanted him, and she had only a few hours in which to get him. If fainting or pretending to faint would do the trick, then she would faint. If simpering, coquetry, or empty-headedness would attract him, she would gladly play the flirt and be more empty-headed than even Kathleen Calvert. And if bolder measures were necessary, she would take them. Today was the day. There was no one to tell Scarlet that her own personality, frighteningly vital though it was more attractive than any masquerade she might adopt. Had she been told, she would have been pleased but unbelieving. And the civilization of which she was a part would have been unbelieving too, for at no time, before or since, had so low a premium been placed on feminine naturalness. As the carriage bore her down the red road toward the Wilkes plantation, Scarlet had a feeling of guilty pleasure that neither her mother nor Mammy was with the party. There would be no one at the barbecue who, by delicately lifted brows or out-thrust underlip, could interfere with her plan of action. Of course, Sue Ellen would be certain to tell tales tomorrow, but if all went as Scarlet hoped, the excitement of the family over her engagement to Ashley or her elopement would more than overbalance their displeasure. Yes, she was very glad Ellen had been forced to stay at home. Gerald, primed with brandy, had given Jonas Wilkerson his dismissal that morning, and Ellen had remained at Tara to go over the accounts of the plantation before he took his departure. Scarlet had kissed her mother goodbye in the little office where she sat before the tall secretary with its paper-stuffed pigeonholes. Jonas Wilkerson, hat in hand, stood beside her, his sallow, tight-skinned face hardly concealing the fury of hate that possessed him at being so unceremoniously turned out of the best overseer's job in the county, and all because of a bit of minor philandering. He had told Gerald over and over that Emmy Slattery's baby might have been fathered by any one of a dozen men as easily as himself. An idea in which Gerald concurred, but that had not altered his case so far as Ellen was concerned. Jonas hated all Southerners. He hated their cool courtesy to him, and their contempt for his social status, so inadequately covered by their courtesy. He hated Ellen O'Hara above anyone else, for she was the epitome of all that he hated in Southerners. Mammy, as head woman of the plantation, had remained to help Ellen, and it was Dilsey who rode on the driver's seat beside Toby, the girl's dancing dresses in a long box across her lap. Gerald rode beside the carriage on his big hunter, warm with brandy, and pleased with himself for having gotten through with the unpleasant business of Wilkerson so speedily. He had shoved the responsibility onto Ellen, and her disappointment at missing the barbecue and the gathering of her friends did not enter his mind. For it was a fine spring day, and his fields were beautiful, and the birds were singing, and he felt too young and frolicsome to think of anyone else. Occasionally, he burst out with Peg in a low-backed car and other Irish ditties, or the more lugubrious lament for Robert Emmet, "She is far from the land where her young hero sleeps." He was happy, pleasantly excited over the prospect of spending the day shouting about Yankees and the war, and proud of his three pretty daughters in their bright spreading hoop skirts beneath foolish little lace parasols. He gave no thought to his conversation of the day before with Scarlett, for it had completely slipped his mind. He only thought that she was pretty and a great credit to him, and that today her eyes were as green as the hills of Ireland. The last thought made him think better of himself, for it had a certain poetic ring to it, and so he favored the girls with a loud and slightly off-key rendition of "The Wearin' of the Green." Scarlett, looking at him with the affectionate contempt that mothers feel for small swaggering sons, knew that he would be very drunk by sundown. Coming home in the dark, he would try, as usual, to jump every fence between Twelve Oaks and Tara, and she hoped, by the mercy of Providence and the good sense of his horse, would escape breaking his neck. He would disdain the bridge, and swim his horse through the river, and come home roaring to be put to bed on a sofa in the office by Pork, who always waited up with a lamp in the front hall on such occasions. He would ruin his new grey broadcloth suit, which would cause him to swear horribly in the morning, and tell Ellen at great length how his horse fell off the bridge in the darkness. A palpable lie which would fool no one, but which would be accepted by all and make him feel very clever. "Pa is a sweet, selfish, irresponsible darling," Scarlett thought, with a surge of affection for him. She felt so excited and happy this morning that she included the whole world, as well as Gerald, in her affection. She was pretty, and she knew it. She would have Ashley for her own before the day was over. The sun was warm and tender, and the glory of the Georgia spring was spread before her eyes. Along the roadside, the blackberry brambles were concealing with softest green the savage red gulches cut by the winter's rains, and the bare granite boulders pushing up through the red earth were being draped with sprangles of Cherokee roses and compassed about by wild violets of palest purple hue. Upon the wooded hills above the river, the dogwood blossoms lay glistening and white, as if snow still lingered among the greenery. The flowering crab trees were bursting their buds and rioting from delicate white to deepest pink, and beneath the trees where the sunshine dappled the pine straw, the wild honeysuckle made a varicolored carpet of scarlet and orange and rose. There was a faint wild fragrance of sweet shrub on the breeze, and the world smelled good enough to eat. "I'll remember how beautiful this day is till I die," thought Scarlett. "Perhaps it will be my wedding day." And she thought with a tingling in her heart how she and Ashley might ride swiftly through this beauty of blossom and greenery this very afternoon, or tonight, by moonlight,
toward Jonesboro, and a preacher. Of course, she would have to be remarried by a priest from Atlanta, but that would be something for Ellen and Gerald to worry about. She quailed a little as she thought how white with mortification Ellen would be at hearing that her daughter had eloped with another girl's fiancé, but she knew Ellen would forgive her when she saw her happiness. And Gerald would scold and bawl, but for all his remarks of yesterday about not wanting her to marry Ashley, he would be pleased beyond words at an alliance between his family and the Wilkes.
"But that'll be something to worry about after I'm married," she thought, tossing the worry from her. It was impossible to feel anything but palpitating joy in this warm sun, in the spring, with the chimney of 12 oaks just beginning to show on the hill across the river. "I'll live there all my life, and I'll see 50 springs like this, and maybe more. And I'll tell my children and my grandchildren how beautiful this spring was, lovelier than any they'll ever see."
She was so happy at this last thought that she joined in the last chorus of "The Wearin' o' the Green," and one Gerald shouted approval.
"I don't know why you're so happy this morning," said Sue Ellen crossly, for the thought still rankled in her mind that she would look far better in Scarlet's green silk dancing frock than its rightful owner would. And why was Scarlet always so selfish about lending her clothes and bonnets? And why did Mother always back her up, declaring green was not Sue Ellen's color? "You know as well as I do that Ashley's engagement is going to be announced tonight. Pa said so this morning. And I know you've been sweet on him for months."
"That's all you know," said Scarlet, putting out her tongue and refusing to lose her good humor. How surprised Miss Sue would be by this time tomorrow morning.
"Susie, you know that's not so," protested Corrine, shocked. "It's Brent that Scarlet cares about."
Scarlet turned smiling green eyes upon her younger sister, wondering how anyone could be so sweet. The whole family knew that Corrine's 13-year-old heart was set upon Brent Tarleton, who never gave her a thought except as Scarlet's baby sister. When Ellen was not present, the O'Haras teased her to tears about him.
"Darling, I don't care a thing about Brent," declared Scarlet, happy enough to be generous. "And he doesn't care a thing about me. Why, he's waiting for you to grow up."
Corrine's round little face became pink as pleasure struggled with incredulity.
"Oh, Scarlet, really? Scarlet, you know Mother said Corrine was too young to think about beaux yet, and there you go putting ideas in her head." "Well, go and tattle and see if I care," replied Scarlet. "You want to hold Sissy back because you know she's going to be prettier than you in a year or so?"
"You'll be keeping civil tongues in your heads this day, or I'll be taking me crop to you," warned Gerald. "Now, whist! Is it wheels I'm hearing? That'll be the Tarletons or the Fontaines."
As they neared the intersecting road that came down the thickly wooded hill from Mimosa and Fairhill, the sound of hooves and carriage wheels became plainer, and clamorous feminine voices raised in pleasant dispute sounded from behind the screen of trees. Gerald, riding ahead, pulled up his horse and signed to Toby to stop the carriage where the two roads met.
"'Tis the Tarleton ladies," he announced to his daughters, his florid face abeam,
for excepting Ellen there was no lady in the county he liked more than the red-haired Mrs. Tarleton.
"And 'tis herself at the reins. Ah, there's a woman with fine hands for a horse. Feather light and strong as rawhide, and pretty enough to kiss for all that. More's the pity none of you have such hands," he added, casting fond but reproving glances at his girls. "With Corrine afraid of the poor beasts, and Sue with hands like sad irons when it comes to reins, and you, puss!"
"Well, at any rate, I've never been thrown," cried Scarlet indignantly. "And Mrs. Tarleton takes a toss at every hunt."
"And breaks a collarbone like a man," said Gerald. "No fainting, no fussing. Now, no more of it, for here she comes."
He stood up in his stirrups and took off his hat with a sweep as the Tarleton carriage, overflowing with girls in bright dresses and parasols and fluttering veils, came into view, with Mrs. Tarleton on the box, as Gerald had said. With her four daughters, their mammy, and their ball dresses in long cardboard boxes crowding the carriage, there was no room for the coachman. And besides, Beatrice Tarleton never willingly permitted anyone, black or white, to hold reins when her arms were out of slings. Frail, fine-boned, so white of skin that her flaming hair seemed to have drawn all the color from her face into its vital burnished mass, she was nevertheless possessed of exuberant health and untiring energy. She had borne 8 children, as red of hair and as full of life as she, and had raised them most successfully, so the county said. Because she gave them all the loving neglect and the stern discipline she gave the colts she bred. "Curb them, but don't break their spirits," was Mrs. Tarleton's motto. She loved horses, and talked horses constantly. She understood them, and handled them better than any man in the county. Colts overflowed the paddock onto the front lawn, even as her 8 children overflowed the rambling house on the hill. And colts and sons and daughters and hunting dogs tagged after her as she went about the plantation. She credited her horses, especially her red mare Nellie, with human intelligence. And if the cares of the house kept her busy beyond the time when she expected to take her daily ride, she put the sugar bowl in the hands of some small pickaninny and said, "Give Nellie a handful and tell her I'll be out directly." Except on rare occasions, she always wore her riding habit, for whether she rode or not, she always expected to ride, and in that expectation put on her habit upon arising. Each morning, rain or shine, Nellie was saddled and walked up and down in front of the house, waiting for the time when Mrs. Tarleton could spare an hour away from her duties. But Fairhill was a difficult plantation to manage, and spare time hard to get. And more often than not, Nellie walked up and down riderless, hour after hour, while Beatrice Tarleton went through the day with a skirt of her habit absently looped over her arm and 6 inches of shining boot showing below it. Today, dressed in dull black silk over unfashionably narrow hoops, she still looked as though in her habit, for the dress was as severely tailored as her riding costume. And the small black hat, with its long black plume perched over one warm, twinkling brown eye, was a replica of the battered old hat she used for hunting. She waved her whip when she saw Gerald, and drew her dancing pair of red horses to a halt. And the 4 girls in the back of the carriage leaned out and gave such vociferous cries of greeting that the team pranced in alarm. To a casual observer, it would seem that years had passed since the Tarletons had seen the O'Haras, instead of only 2 days. But they were a sociable family, and liked their neighbors, especially the O'Hara girls. That is, they liked Sue Ellen and Corrine. No girl in the county, with the possible exception of the empty-headed Kathleen Calvert, really liked Scarlett. In summers, the county averaged a barbecue and a ball nearly every week. But to the red-haired Tarletons, with their enormous capacity for enjoying themselves, each barbecue and each ball was as exciting as if it were the first they had ever attended. They were a pretty buxom quartet, so crammed into the carriage that their hoops and flounces overlapped, and their parasols nudged and bumped together above their wide leghorn sun hats. Crowned with roses and dangling with black velvet chin ribbons. All shades of red hair were represented beneath these hats. Hetty's plain red hair, Camilla's strawberry blonde, Randa's coppery auburn, and small Betsy's carrot top. "That's a fine bevy, ma'am," said Gerald gallantly, reining his horse alongside the carriage. "But it's far they'll go to beat their mother." Mrs. Tarleton rolled her red-brown eyes and sucked in her lower lip in burlesqued appreciation. And the girls cried,
"Ma, stop making eyes or we'll tell Pa."
"I vow, Mr. O'Hara, she never gives us a chance when there's a handsome man like you around."
Scarlett laughed with the rest at these sallies, but, as always, the freedom with which the Tarletons treated their mother came as a shock. They acted as if she were one of themselves and not a day over 16. To Scarlett, the very idea of saying such things to her own mother was almost sacrilegious. And yet, there was something very pleasant about the Tarleton girls' relations with their mother. And they adored her for all that they criticized and scolded and teased her. Not, Scarlett loyally hastened to tell herself, that she would prefer a mother like Mrs. Tarleton to Ellen, but still, it would be fun to romp with a mother. She knew that even that thought was disrespectful to Ellen and felt ashamed of it. She knew no such troublesome thoughts ever disturbed the brains under the four flaming thatches in the carriage, and, as always, when she felt herself different from her neighbors, an irritated confusion fell upon her. Quick though her brain was, it was not made for analysis. But she half-consciously realized that, for all, the Tarleton girls were as unruly as colts and wild as March hares. There was an unworried single-mindedness about them that was part of their inheritance. On both their mother's and their father's side, they were Georgians, North Georgians, only a generation away from pioneers. They were sure of themselves and of their environment. They knew instinctively what they were about, as did the Wilkeses, though in widely divergent ways. And in them there was no such conflict as frequently raged in Scarlett's bosom, where the blood of a soft-voiced, overbred coast aristocrat mingled with the shrewd, earthy blood of an Irish peasant. Scarlett wanted to respect and adore her mother like an idol, and to rumple her hair and tease her, too. And she knew she should be altogether one way or the other. It was the same conflicting emotion that made her desire to appear a delicate and high-bred lady with boys, and to be as well a hoyden, who was not above a few kisses. "Where's Ellen this morning?" asked Mrs. Tarleton. "She's after discharging our overseer, and stayed home to go over the accounts with him. Where's himself and the lads?"
"Oh, they rode over to 12 Oaks hours ago, to sample the punch and see if it was strong enough, I dare say, as if they wouldn't have from now till tomorrow morning to do it. I'm going to ask John Wilkes to keep them overnight, even if he has to bed them down in the stable. 5 men in their cups are just too much for me. Up to 3, I do very well, but—"
Gerald hastily interrupted to change the subject. He could feel his own daughter snickering behind his back as they remembered in what condition he had come home from the Wilkes's last barbecue the autumn before.
"And why aren't you riding today, Mrs. Tarleton? Sure you don't look yourself at all without Nellie. It's a stentor you are."
"A stentor, me ignorant broth of a boy," cried Mrs. Tarleton, aping his brogue.
"You mean centaur. Stentor was a man with a voice like a brass gong." "Stentor or centaur, 'tis no matter," answered Gerald, unruffled by his error. "And 'tis a voice like brass you have, ma'am, when you're urging on the hounds, so it is."
"That's one on you, ma," said Hetty. "I told you you yelled like a Comanche whenever you saw a fox."
"But not as loud as you yell when Mammy washes your ears," returned Mrs. Tarleton. "And you 16. Well, as to why I'm not riding today, Nellie foaled early this morning."
"Dead she now?"
cried Gerald with real interest, his Irishman's passion for horses shining in his eyes. And Scarlett again felt the sense of shock in comparing her mother with Mrs. Tarleton. To Ellen, mares never foaled, nor cows calved. In fact, hens almost didn't lay eggs. Ellen ignored these matters completely. But Mrs. Tarleton had no such reticences.
A little filly, was it?
No, a fine little stallion with legs 2 yards long. You must ride over and see him, Mr. O'Hara. He's a real Tarleton horse. He's as red as Hetty's curls.
And looks a lot like Hetty, too, said Camilla.
And then disappeared, shrieking amid a welter of skirts and pantalettes and bobbing hats, as Hetty, who did have a long face, began pinching her.
"My fillies are feeling their oats this morning," said Mrs. Tarleton. "They've been kicking up their heels ever since we heard the news this morning about Ashley and that little cousin of his from Atlanta.
What's her name? Melanie?
Bless the child, she's a sweet little thing, but I can never remember either her name or her face. Our cook is the broad wife of the Wilkes butler, and he was over last night with the news that the engagement would be announced tonight, and Cookie told us this morning. The girls are all excited about it, though I can't see why. Everybody's known for years that Ashley would marry her. That is, if he didn't marry one of his Burr cousins from Macon. Just like Honey Wilkes is going to marry Melanie's brother Charles.
Now tell me, Mr. O'Hara, is it illegal for the Wilkes to marry outside of their family? Because if...
Scarlett did not hear the rest of the laughing words. For one short instant, it was as though the sun had ducked behind a cool cloud, leaving the world in shadow, taking the color out of things. The freshly green foliage looked sickly, the dogwood pallid, the flowering crab, so beautifully pink a moment ago, faded and dreary. Scarlett dug her fingers into the upholstery of the carriage, and for a moment her parasol wavered. It was one thing to know that Ashley was engaged, but it was another to hear people talk about it so casually. Then her courage flowed strongly back, and the sun came out again and the landscape glowed anew. She knew Ashley loved her. That was certain. And she smiled as she thought how surprised Mrs. Tarleton would be when no engagement was announced that night, how surprised if there were an elopement. And she'd tell neighbors what a sly boots Scarlett was to sit there and listen to her talk about Melanie when all the time she and Ashley... She dimpled at her own thoughts. And Hetty, who had been watching sharply the effect of her mother's words, sank back with a small puzzled frown.
"I don't care what you say, Mr. O'Hara," Mrs. Tarleton was saying emphatically. "It's all wrong, this marrying of cousins. It's bad enough for Ashley to be marrying the Hamilton child. But for Honey to be marrying that pale-looking Charles Hamilton...
Honey'll never catch anybody else if she doesn't marry Charlie," said Randa, cruel and secure in her own popularity. "She's never had another beau except him. And he's never acted very sweet on her, for all that they're engaged. Scarlett, you remember how he ran after you last Christmas?"
"Don't be a cat, miss," said her mother. "Cousins shouldn't marry, even second cousins. It weakens the strain. It isn't like horses. You can breed a mare to a brother or a sire to a daughter, and get good results if you know your blood strains, but in people it just doesn't work. You get good lines, perhaps, but no stamina. You...
Now, ma'am, I'm taking issue with you on that. Can you name me better people than the Wilkes? And they've been intermarrying since Brian Boru was a boy."
And high time they stopped it, for it's beginning to show. Oh, not Ashley so much, for he's a good-looking devil, though even he... But look at those two washed-out-looking Wilkes girls, poor things. Nice girls, of course, but washed out. And look at little Miss Melanie, thin as a rail, and delicate enough for the wind to blow away, and no spirit at all. Not a notion of her own. No, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. That's all she has to say. You see what I mean? That family needs new blood, fine, vigorous blood, like my redheads or your Scarlet. Now, don't misunderstand me. The Wilkes are fine folks in their way, and you know I'm fond of them all, but be frank. They're overbred and inbred, too, aren't they?
They'll do fine on a dry track, a fast track, but mark my words, I don't believe the Wilks can run on a mud track. I believe the stamina has been bred out of them, and when the emergency arises, I don't believe they can run against odds. Dry weather stock. Give me a big horse who can run in any weather. And their intermarrying has made them different from other folks around here. Always fiddling with a piano or sticking their heads in a book. I do believe Ashley would rather read than hunt. Yes, I honestly believe that, Mr. O'Hara. And just look at the bones on them. Too slender. They need dams and sires with strength.
Said Gerald, suddenly, and guiltily aware that the conversation, a most interesting and entirely proper one to him, would seem quite otherwise to Ellen. In fact, he knew she would never recover should she learn that her daughters had been exposed to so frank a conversation. But Mrs. Tarleton was, as usual, deaf to all other ideas when pursuing her favorite topic, breeding, whether it be horses or humans. I know what I'm talking about, because I had some cousins who married each other, and I give you my word, their children all turned out as pop-eyed as bullfrogs, poor things. And when my family wanted me to marry a second cousin, I bucked like a colt. I said, no more, not for me. My children will all have spavins and heaves. Well, Ma fainted when I said that, about spavins. But I stood firm, and Grandma backed me up. She knew a lot about horse breeding, too, you see, and said I was right. And she helped me run away with Mr. Tarleton. And look at my children. Big and healthy, and not a sickly one or a runt among them, though Boyd is only 5'10". Now, the Wilks. Not meaning to change the subject, ma'am, broke in Gerald hurriedly, for he noticed Corrine's bewildered look and the avid curiosity on Sue Ellen's face, and feared lest they might ask Ellen embarrassing questions which would reveal how inadequate a chaperone he was. Puss, he was glad to notice, appeared to be thinking of other matters as a lady should. Hetty Tarleton rescued him from his predicament.
"Good heavens, Ma, do let's get on," she cried impatiently. "The sun is broiling me, and I can just hear freckles popping out on my neck."
"Just a minute, ma'am, before you go," said Gerald. "But what have you decided to do about selling us the horses for the troop? War may break any day now, and the boys want the matter settled. It's a Clayton County troop, and it's Clayton County horses we want for them. But you, obstinate creature that you are still refusing to sell us your fine beasts."
"Maybe there won't be any war," Mrs. Tarleton temporized, her mind diverted completely from the Wilkes's odd marriage habits.
"Why, ma'am, you can't—"
"Ma," Hetty interrupted again. "Can't you and Mr. O'Hara talk about the horses at 12 Oaks as well as here?"
"That's just it, Miss Hetty," said Gerald. "And I won't be keeping you but 1 minute by the clock. We'll be getting to 12 Oaks in a little bit, and every man there, old and young, wanting to know about the horses. Ah, but it's breaking me heart to see such a fine, pretty lady as your mother so stingy with her beasts. Now, where's your patriotism, Mrs. Tarleton? Does the Confederacy mean nothing to you at all?"
"Ma," cried small Betsy, "Randa's sitting on my dress and I'm getting all wrinkled."
"Well, push Randa off you, Betsy, and hush. Now listen to me, Gerald O'Hara," she retorted, her eyes beginning to snap. "Don't you go throwing the Confederacy in my face. I reckon the Confederacy means as much to me as it does to you, me with 4 boys in the troop and you with none. But my boys can take care of themselves and my horses can't. I'd gladly give the horses free of charge if I knew they were going to be ridden by boys I know, gentlemen used to thoroughbreds. No, I wouldn't hesitate a minute. But let my beauties be at the mercy of backwoodsmen and crackers who are used to riding mules. No, sir. I'd have nightmares thinking they were being ridden with saddle galls and not groomed properly. Do you think I'd let ignorant fools ride my tender-mouthed darlings and saw their mouths to pieces and
beat them till their spirits were broken. Why, I've got goose flesh this minute, just thinking about it. No, Mr. O'Hara, you're mighty nice to want my horses, but you'd better go to Atlanta and buy some old plugs for your clod hoppers. They'll never know the difference.
Ma, can't we please go on? Asked Camilla, joining the impatient chorus. You know mighty well you're going to end up giving them your darlings anyhow. When Pa and the boys get through talking about the Confederacy needing them and so on, you cry and let them go.
Mrs. Tarleton grinned and shook the lines. I'll do no such thing, she said, touching the horses lightly with a whip. The carriage went off swiftly.
That's a fine woman, said Gerald, putting on his hat and taking his place beside his own carriage. Drive on, Toby. We'll wear her down and get the horses yet. Of course, she's right. She's right. If a man's not a gentleman, he's no business on a horse. The infantry is the place for him. But more's the pity. There's not enough planter's sons in this county to make up a full troop.
What did you say, Puss?
Pa, please ride beside us or in front of us. You kick up such a heap of dust that we're choking, said Scarlet, who felt that she could endure conversation no longer. It distracted her from her thoughts, and she was very anxious to arrange both her thoughts and her face in attractive lines before reaching Twelve Oaks. Gerald obediently put spurs to his horse, and was off in a red cloud after the Tarleton carriage, where he could continue his horsey conversation.
Chapter 6
They crossed the river, and the carriage mounted the hill. Even before Twelve Oaks came into view, Scarlet saw a haze of smoke hanging lazily in the tops of the tall trees, and smelled the mingled savory odors of burning hickory logs and roasting pork and mutton. The barbecue pits, which had been slowly burning since last night, would now be long troughs of rose-red embers, with the meats turning on spits above them and the juices trickling down and hissing into the coals. Scarlet knew that the fragrance carried on the faint breeze came from the grove of great oaks in the rear of the big house. John Wilkes always held his barbecues there, on the gentle slope leading down to the rose garden, a pleasant shady place, and a far pleasanter place, for instance, than that used by the Calverts. Mrs. Calvert did not like barbecue food, and declared that the smells remained in the house for days, so her guests always sweltered on a flat, unshaded spot a quarter of a mile from the house. But John Wilkes, famed throughout the state for his hospitality, really knew how to give a barbecue. The long, trestled picnic tables, covered with the finest of the Wilkes linen, always stood under the thickest shade, with backless benches on either side. And chairs, hassocks, and cushions from the house were scattered about the glade for those who did not fancy the benches. At a distance great enough to keep the smoke away from the guests were the long pits where the meats cooked and the huge iron washpots from which the succulent odors of barbecue sauce and Brunswick stew floated. Mr. Wilkes always had at least a dozen darkies busy running back and forth, with trays to serve the guests. Over behind the barns there was always another barbecue pit, where the house servants and the coachmen and maids of the guests had their own feast of hoe cakes and yams and chitlins, that dish of hog entrails so dear to Negro hearts, and in season, watermelons enough to satiate. As the smell of crisp, fresh pork came to her, Scarlet wrinkled her nose appreciatively, hoping that by the time it was cooked she would feel some appetite. As it was, she was so full of food and so tightly laced that she feared every moment she was going to belch. That would be fatal, as only old men and very old ladies could belch without fear of social disapproval. They topped the rise, and the White House reared its perfect symmetry before her, tall of columns, wide of verandas, flat of roof, beautiful as a woman is beautiful, who is so sure of her charm that she can be generous and gracious to all. Scarlet loved 12 Oaks, even more than Tara, for it had a stately beauty, a mellowed dignity that Gerald's house did not possess. The wide, curving driveway was full of saddle horses and carriages, and guests alighting and calling greetings to friends. Grinning negroes, excited as always at a party, were leading the animals to the barnyard to be unharnessed and unsaddled for the day. Swarms of children, black and white, ran yelling about the newly green lawn, playing hopscotch and tag and boasting how much they were going to eat. The wide hall, which ran from front to back of the house, was swarming with people, and as the O'Hara carriage drew up at the front steps, Scarlet saw girls in crinolines, bright as butterflies, going up and coming down the stairs from the second floor, arms about each other's waists, stopping to lean over the delicate handrail of the banisters, laughing and calling to young men in the hall below them. Through the open French windows, she caught glimpses of the older women seated in the drawing-room, sedate in dark silks as they sat fanning themselves, and talking of babies and sicknesses, and who had married whom and why. The Wilkes butler, Tom, was hurrying through the halls, a silver tray in his hands, bowing and grinning, as he offered tall glasses to young men in fawn and grey trousers and fine ruffled linen shirts. The sunny front veranda was thronged with guests. Yes, the whole county was here, thought Scarlet. The 4 Tarleton boys and their father leaned against the tall columns, the twins Stuart and Brent side by side, inseparable, as usual, Boyd and Tom with their father, James Tarleton. Mr. Calvert was standing close by the side of his Yankee wife, who even after 15 years in Georgia never seemed to quite belong anywhere. Everyone was very polite and kind to her, because he felt sorry for her, but no one could forget that she had compounded her initial error of birth by being the governess of Mr. Calvert's children. The 2 Calvert boys, Rayford and Cade, were there with their dashing blonde sister, Kathleen, teasing the dark-faced Joe Fontaine and Sally Monroe, his pretty bride-to-be. Alex and Tony Fontaine were whispering in the ears of Dimity Monroe and sending her into gales of giggles. There were families from as far as Lovejoy, 10 miles away, and from Fayetteville and Jonesboro, a few even from Atlanta and Macon. The house seemed bursting with a crowd, and a ceaseless babble of talking and laughter and giggles and shrill feminine squeaks and screams rose and fell. On the porch steps stood John Wilkes, silver-haired, erect, radiating the quiet charm and hospitality that was as warm and never-failing as the sun of Georgia summer. Beside him, Honey Wilkes, so called because she indiscriminately addressed everyone from her father to the field hands by that endearment, fidgeted and giggled as she called greetings to the arriving guests. Honey's nervously obvious desire to be attractive to every man in sight contrasted sharply with her father's poise. And Scarlet had the thought that perhaps there was something in what Mrs. Tarleton said after all. Certainly the Wilkes men got the family looks. The thick, deep gold lashes that set off the grey eyes of John Wilkes and Ashley were sparse and colourless in the faces of Honey and her sister India. Honey had the odd, lashless look of a rabbit, and India could be described by no other word than plain. India was nowhere to be seen. But Scarlet knew she probably was in the kitchen giving final instructions to the servants. Poor India, thought Scarlet. She's had so much trouble keeping house since her mother died that she's never had the chance to catch any beau except Stuart Tarleton. And it certainly wasn't my fault if he thought I was prettier than she. John Wilkes came down the steps to offer his arm to Scarlet. As she descended from the carriage, she saw Sue Ellen smirk and knew that she must have picked out Frank Kennedy in the crowd. "If I couldn't catch a better beau than that old maid in breeches," she thought contemptuously, as she stepped to the ground and smiled her thanks to John Wilkes. Frank Kennedy was hurrying to the carriage to assist Sue Ellen, and Sue Ellen was bridling in a way that made Scarlett want to slap her. Frank Kennedy might own more land than anyone in the county, and he might have a very kind heart, but these things counted for nothing against the fact that he was 40 slight and nervous and had a thin ginger-colored beard and an old maidish, fussy way about him. However, remembering her plan, Scarlett smothered her contempt and cast such a flashing smile of greeting at him that he stopped short, his arm outheld to Sue Ellen, and goggled at Scarlett in pleased bewilderment. Scarlett's eyes searched the crowd for Ashley, even while she made pleasant small talk with John Wilkes, but he was not on the porch. There were cries of greeting from a dozen voices, and Stuart and Brent Tarleton moved toward her. The Monroe girls rushed up to exclaim over her dress, and she was speedily the center of a circle of voices that rose higher and higher in efforts to be heard above the din. But where was Ashley? And Melanie and Charles? She tried not to be obvious as she looked about and peered down the hall into the laughing group inside. As she chattered and laughed and cast quick glances into the house and the yard, her eyes fell on a stranger, standing alone in the hall, staring at her in a cool, impertinent way that brought her up sharply with a mingled feeling of feminine pleasure that she had attracted a man, and an embarrassed sensation that her dress was too low in the bosom. He looked quite old, at least 35. He was a tall man and powerfully built. Scarlett thought she had never seen a man with such wide shoulders, so heavy with muscles, almost too heavy for gentility. When her eye caught his, he smiled, showing animal white teeth below a close-clipped black moustache. He was dark of face, swarthy as a pirate, and his eyes were as bold and black as any pirate's appraising a galleon to be scuttled, or a maiden to be ravished. There was a cool recklessness in his face, and a cynical humor in his mouth as he smiled at her, and Scarlett caught her breath. She felt that she should be insulted by such a look, and was annoyed with herself because she did not feel insulted. She did not know who he could be, but there was undeniably a look of good blood in his dark face. It showed in the thin hawk nose over the full red lips, the high forehead, and the wide-set eyes. She dragged her eyes away from his without smiling back, and he turned as someone called, Rhett Butler, come here. I want you to meet the most hard-hearted girl in Georgia. Rhett Butler? The name had a familiar sound, somehow connected with something pleasantly scandalous. But her mind was on Ashley, and she dismissed the thought. "I must run upstairs and smooth my hair," she told Stuart and Brent, who were trying to get her cornered from the crowd. "You boys wait for me and don't run off with any other girl, or I'll be furious." She could see that Stuart was going to be difficult to handle today if she flirted with anyone else. He had been drinking, and wore the arrogant, looking-for-a-fight expression that she knew from experience meant trouble. She paused in the hall to speak to friends and to greet India, who was emerging from the back of the house, her hair untidy and tiny beads of perspiration on her forehead. Poor India. It would be bad enough to have pale hair and eyelashes and a jutting chin that meant a stubborn disposition, without being 20 years old and an old maid in the bargain. She wondered if India resented very much her taking Stuart away from her. Lots of people said she was still in love with him, but then you could never tell what a Wilkes was thinking about. If she did resent it, she never gave any sign of it, treating Scarlett with the same slightly aloof, kindly courtesy she had always shown her. Scarlett spoke pleasantly to her and started up the wide stairs.
As she did, a shy voice behind her called her name, and, turning, she saw Charles Hamilton. He was a nice-looking boy with a riot of soft brown curls on his white forehead, and eyes as deep brown, as clean, and as gentle as a collie dog's. He was well turned out in mustard-colored trousers and black coat, and his pleated shirt was topped by the widest and most fashionable of black cravats. A faint blush was creeping over his face as she turned, for he was timid with girls. Like most shy men, he greatly admired airy, vivacious, always-at-ease girls like Scarlett. She had never given him more than perfunctory courtesy before, and so the beaming smile of pleasure with which she greeted him, and the two hands outstretched to his, almost took his breath away.
"Why, Charles Hamilton, you handsome old thing, you. I'll bet you came all the way down here from Atlanta just to break my poor heart."
Charles almost stuttered with excitement, holding her warm little hands in his and looking into the dancing green eyes. This was the way girls talked to other boys, but never to him. He never knew why, but girls always treated him like a younger brother and were very kind, but never bothered to tease him. He had always wanted girls to flirt and frolic with him as they did with boys much less handsome and less endowed with this world's goods than he. But on the few occasions when this had happened, he could never think of anything to say, and he suffered agonies of embarrassment at his dumbness. Then he lay awake at night thinking of all the charming gallantries he might have employed. But he rarely got a second chance, for the girls left him alone after a trial or two. Even with Honey, with whom he had an unspoken understanding of marriage when he came into his property next fall, he was diffident and silent. At times, he had an ungallant feeling that Honey's coquetries and proprietary airs were no credit to him, for she was so boy-crazy, he imagined she would use them on any man who gave her the opportunity. Charles was not excited over the prospect of marrying her, for she stirred in him none of the emotions of wild romance that his beloved books had assured